I think we're just about ready to get started here. Today's speaker is Gabriel Sampson, who is a National Network of Environmental Management Studies Fellow, a NEMS Fellow, with the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. He is a current master's student studying environmental economics and policy at the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management at UC Santa Barbara. His prior service includes work with Shaw Environmental and Infrastructure and the U.S. Forest Service. Gabriel's presentation will focus on the technical and regulatory considerations of siting solar installations on closed landfills. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Gabriel to give the presentation. And I just would like to remind you one more time to please put your phone on mute. If you don't have a mute button, push *6. Thank you. Gabe.
All right, well, thank you, Penelope, for agreeing to moderate this seminar here. Thanks to everyone out in the audience for tuning in today. I appreciate all the attention. I'd like to mention the draft paper should be posted, and there's also some good resources on the resources page, so I encourage people to take a look at those, time permitting. With that, we'll get started. The title of today's seminar is Solar Installations on Closed Landfills, Technical and Regulatory Considerations. Now, I anticipate talking for about 30 minutes and then leaving the remainder of the hour for question and comment period. So, moving on to slide 2. Now, the purpose of this briefing is to summarize the findings from my summer fellowship paper. That was addressing the technical and regulatory challenges of installing solar energy systems on closed landfills. Now, this briefing will first identify the opportunity for solar on landfills. Secondly, I will briefly address the relevant systems available. Third, I will cover the technical challenges and potential solutions. Fourth, I will address regulatory complications, and then I will close with some specific case evidence of successful projects. Moving on to slide 3, the problem statement. Now, the estimates for the number of closed landfills in the U.S. Have been as high as 100,000, according to Sufflet et al., 1992. Now, if we believe these numbers, then there is a huge potential for these type of projects. And furthermore, EPA's Repowering America's Lands initiative has identified several benefits to using contaminated lands for siting clean and renewable energy, such as they may have lower transaction costs in green fields. Developing brownfields could reduce development demand for green fields, and conditions on contaminated lands may allow for only limited development. However, current challenges in the technical and regulatory context have complicated brownfields development in general and landfill solar projects in particular. So moving on to slide 4. This slide provides an introduction to the components of a ground-mounted system. For the most part, you have the basic elements of aluminum or steel stanchions connected to a variety of different foundation materials, all with different weight properties and suitabilities. And I've listed some of the foundation materials here, such as concrete pillars, concrete slab, and ballast, and this will be discussed in further detail later on. Moving on to slide 5. Now, this is a picture showcasing just a basic A-frame design. You can see the shell of concrete pillars here, and it looks like aluminum stanchion supporting the PV panels. Moving on to slide 6, solar technologies. Now, there are two solar technologies available for these types of applications, concentrating solar power and photovoltaic, which will be referred to as CSP and PV, respectively, from now on. Now, this slide covers the PV components. And actually, the entire seminar and my paper focused largely on PV because I'm unaware of any CSP installations on landfills. But this could be a good topic for another study in the future. Now with PV, there are basically three panel types available and three mounting structure types available. Those being thin film, polycrystalline, monocrystalline, and fixed tilt, single, and double axis trackers. Each panel type and mounting structure has contacts, which they're preferential. This will be covered in further detail later on also. Moving on to slide 7. So the second solar technology is CSP. As I said, in the interest of being frank, I'm not aware of any projects currently utilizing CSP technology. But CSP can be further broken down into three categories: linear concentrators, power towers, and dish engine systems. Now, generally speaking, linear concentrators and power towers will be optimal with larger scale projects of 50 megawatts or more. And this is because the linear concentrators and power towers collect heat that is driven at turbine generators that are centrally located. And the cost per kilowatt decreases with larger scale operations. And now this could be a reason why the haven't seen the CSP on landfills, because the amount of land is sort of a prohibitive factor. Now, dish engine systems are better suited to smaller scale production scales because they're modular systems. However, they do need a flat grade to provide adequate support, and this could be another negative factor for CSP on landfills. Now, for more information, there's a great paper by Stoddard et al. From 2006 that was put together for the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. I encourage people to take a look at that. Okay, moving on to slide 8, getting into weight considerations now. Okay, with respect to weight considerations, I'll lump together monocrystalline and polycrystalline cells in the interest of simplicity and comparability. Thin film panels will generally be lighter in weight and are manufactured on flexible materials. However, on the average, they are less efficient than crystalline panels on a power output per unit area basis. Now, crystalline panels will be heavier and more rigid than the thin films, but they do have the advantage in power production. And finally, monocrystalline cells have the efficiency advantage over polycrystalline. Now, whether the weight properties of the different cells will be significant will depend on the resiliency of the site with respect to the ability to support weight. And keep in mind that these are generalizations, and it's very possible to deviate from these generalizations. Moving on to slide 9. Here in this table, you can see some of these deviations from the general. Now, these data were collected from an online catalog provided by wholesalesolar.com. And you can see here that some of the crystalline cells have an advantage in a watts per pound ratio over some of the thin film cells. And another thing to take away from the cell is the unisolar flexible laminates that have recently become available, and this could mark a new direction in the thin film technology field. Moving on to slide 10, this picture showcases the aforementioned PV laminates. This is a picture from the Tessman Road landfill out in San Antonio, Texas. Moving on to slide 11. So we just covered the weight considerations of the panels, and now we'll get into the further considerations of the mounting structures and the foundation materials. So single and double axis tracking systems will be heavier than a fixed tilt mounting structure, and they will probably require deeper piers and footings, which will, again, add to the overall weight. And because of the increased weight, there is a increased concern of settlement and slide slope stability. Now, there are three foundation categories I've covered here. Oh, this shows four, but I show four also. Should be three. Okay. Anyhow, so the first one is ballasted platforms. Sure, lightweight option, and can be placed onto or shallowly into the landfill cap. However, engineering complications could arise with slide slope installations. They don't provide very powerful anchors for those side slopes. The second one is poured and prefabricated shallow concrete footings, another lighter weight option. These are generally installed at shallow depths into the landfill cap and offer greater foundational stability than the ballast. The last one is concrete slab, which is a relatively heavy option, and complications arise with settlement. Occurrences of settlement can actually crack the concrete, so that's something to bear in mind. Now these weight considerations that were given were for individual foundations, and cumulative weights will be different per the design of the system as a whole. Moving on to slide 12. Wind and snow loading. Now, wind and snow loading can place dynamic stress on the solar system mounting and foundational components and the landfill cap itself. I believe the International Electrotechnical Commission standard is roughly 50 pounds per square foot or 105 miles per hour for photovoltaic panels. Someone correct me if I'm wrong on that one. But areas that are prone to extreme wind and snow events may wish to consider a higher mechanical load rating. There's also a need to consider routine cap maintenance with respect to wind loading. For example, consider how high the solar panels need to be positioned to allow room for future vegetation management. That is, will a tractor or a lawnmower have adequate room to be to allow for mowing. And the elevated panel heights will require deeper footings and longer stanchions, and this could in turn lead to increased wind loading by virtue of the increased vertical height. For projects where side slope installations are considered, need to evaluate the increased pressure placed on solar components from snow accumulation, and then choose components that have adequate ratings. Moving on to slide 13. Here we get into the technical challenges that landfills provide to solar projects. Just a brief overview of settlement. So over time, various processes can change the properties of a waste buried in landfills. And these properties can include mechanical consolidation, biochemical degradation, physiochemical change, graveling, and any combination of those. Now, the degree of settlement will depend on the waste age, composition, method of placement, and depth. So do a thorough background search to accurately model or predict the expected rate and amount of settlement. Moving on to slide 14, continuing on with settlement here. So differential settlement causes problems to both the site remedy and the solar energy system. With respect to the site remedy, damages can include surface cracks in the landfill cap, water drainage system damages, leachate and gas collection piping damage, formation of water holding depressions, and underground utility damage. Now, with respect to the solar system, damages may include cracks in the concrete foundations, which I previously mentioned with the slab foundation, and disruption of the angle of the solar panels with respect to the sun. Now, the panels are placed such that solar exposure is optimized, and any landscape shifts that disrupt this angle will decrease the ultimate electricity output of the system. Moving on to slide 15. Okay, so what are some of the things to consider when settlement is a concern? Well, if you want a fixed tilt or a sun tracking array, like I mentioned, settlement is likely to impact tracking arrays more substantially than a fixed tilt array. And you also want to try to use stanchions that have some level of flexibility to account for any shifting that occurs to the landscape. And with respect to foundations, slab foundations are likely to experience cracking from landscape shifts. So you may want to consider ballast or shallow concrete footings instead. With respect to weight, with settlement a concern, you don't want to exacerbate settlement with a heavy solar system. So consider the weight characteristics of a slab foundation versus ballast and shallow footings, and also the weight characteristics of crystalline panels versus a thin film panel arrangement. Now, there also are some mitigation strategies here, and I broke them down into a simultaneous closure and development projects versus projects taking place on previously closed landfills. For simultaneous closure and development, you have available dynamic compaction, selective waste removal, and importation of clean fill. And for prior previously closed landfills, you have geogrid reinforcement, the use of shims and adjustable racking systems to allow for flexibility in your mounting structures, and the option of selective placement. That is, old construction debris is less likely to experience settlement when compared to more biochemically active waste. So if you're considering two landfills, one is construction debris that was landfilled in the 1970s versus a municipal solid waste landfill that was buried in the early 2000s, the older one will probably be preferential. This is a good option for sites with multiple landfills that exhibit different waste properties among them. Moving on to slide 16. Here we get into cover material integrity. So obviously care is to be taken during clearing and grading activities so as not to puncture the cap. Now this is especially relevant to sites that are heavily vegetated with deep root structures. Now you wanted to determine the thickness of the soil cap for several reasons. Are there any thin spots? Does your solar manufacturer recommend installation on flat surfaces? Do you have a flat surface? Are you planning to trench your electrical lines? And if so, is there sufficient cover? If not, may be necessary to import or to redistribute soil from thicker to thinner areas. But also keep in mind the regulatory requirements when manipulating the landfill cover, and under no circumstances you should disturb it without a prior approval from your local regulator. Moving on to slide 17. Here we get into site slope stability, which is previously mentioned with respect to snow loading. So determine early on if slope instability will be a concern and if slope installation will be feasible at your site. On the average, the site slopes will become more stable with time, which is just something to keep in mind for newer landfills if you're considering a slope installation. Now, building on steep slide slopes also involves some levels of complication, including the increased erosion and stormwater control systems, increased operations and maintenance costs associated with stormwater and erosion, and the need for stronger foundations to anchor the arrays. And as I previously mentioned, should factor in the increased stress that snow and ice loading will cause. Moving on to slide 18. This will be the last slide with respect to technical challenges. Second to last, actually. One should consider how the solar system will interface with the future routine settlement surveys, landfill gas surveys, gas extraction activities, erosion inspections, and routine cap maintenance. A good example that I previously mentioned was consideration of panel height with respect to vegetation management. And a second example that I can think of is the placement of solar arrays such that future gas sampling will not be obstructed. And a final thing to consider is the whether the construction of an access road will be necessary. All other things equal, a site with an existing access road and top deck access will be preferred over a site without one. Moving on to slide 19. This is a table showcasing some of the complications, challenges, potential remedies that I had just discussed. And I tried to go through and identify relevant casework that corresponds to each complication. I apologize for not finding case studies for wind loading and routine camp maintenance. Moving on to slide 20, here we get into some of the regulatory concerns. So most landfills will correspond to RCRA Subtitle D, and therefore state and local governments will be responsible for the primary planning, permitting, regulation, implementation, and enforcement. But the good news is a 2008 survey conducted by Peter Masson at HDR Engineering revealed that none of the 13 responding states had ordinances against developing landfills. So that's the encouraging news. Now, permitting can be further complicated with respect to unpermitted landfill closures and alternative cover designs. So if you have either of these two characteristics, you should expect increased length in your permitting timeline. Moving on to slide 21, again referring to the Tessman Road project, this is a their example of their alternative cover design. They used a flexible laminate fixed directly to an exposed geomembrane. So that's a good example of an alternative cover with respect to solar installations. Moving on to slide 22. This is a slide showcasing a list of materials that are required when submitting for a post-closure use permit in Massachusetts. I admit that this is a busy slide, but it was sort of designed that way just to exemplify how comprehensive a list can be. These data retrieved directly from the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection website. Should be fairly straightforward to get a similar list from your state as well. Moving on to slide 23, zoning and local land use. Now, because state and local governments are responsible for the oversight of RCRA Subtitle D sites, reference should be made to them for zoning and land use changes. It's the responsibility of the work party to notify the local environmental agencies of land use changes. And as a quick example here of the level of state oversight involved here, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency owns 25 of the state's 112 landfills under the state closed landfill program. The remaining 87 are privately owned or owned by local governments. Even so, the MPCA has the right to limit land use on all 112 sites. So this is an example of the ultimate decision coming down to the state. Moving on to slide 24, environmental site investigations. I think it's valuable to briefly go over ESIs with respect to solar installments because an ESI will likely be required for your development. In some cases, a previously conducted ESI can be used to fulfill the post-closure development application. The party should check with the local environmental regulators to confirm. Now, another useful purpose for the ESI or other site investigation is to determine things like wellhead locations and to confirm those locations on the site maps. And then, of course, to plan the placement of your array, your solar array accordingly. Moving on to slide 25, which will be last, but perhaps most importantly, protect your pocketbook. Liability under CERCLA. In 2002, the Brownsfield Law was passed, providing some liability protection to bona fide prospective purchasers. in order to claim liability protection under that law, you need to conduct all appropriate inquiries. So that's something important to keep in mind. The other bit of good news is the EPA has some tools available to help navigate some CERCLA liability. Among those are the comfort and status letters, which can basically provide a better understanding of EPA's involvement or likely involvement in a project, and also windfall lien resolution agreements, which could release and waive any windfall lien through the payment of cash or other agreement. Now, in addition to the EPA tools, some tools are available at the state level, which takes us into slide 26. This is a table outlining some various liability protections offered by various states. This was retrieved from a great paper by the National Association of Local Government Environmental Professionals, and I've attached a link here at the bottom of the page. I encourage everyone to take a look at that. So be sure to check with your specific state to see if there are any liability protections offered. Right. Now on to slide 27, which is the first of a series of slides showcasing case evidence. Now the first one here is Fort Carson. Now, each case slide will include some basic pedigree information and a list of materials and components used at the site. So the landfill at Fort Carson was mostly construction debris. It was closed in 1973. The solar array became fully operational on January 8, 2008. The project was completed in 18 months, including 3 months for construction. The solar array covers 12 acres and provides enough electricity to power 540 homes. For more information, you can contact Vince Guthrie at Fort Carson there. I've included his email address at the bottom. Moving on to slide 28, you can see a picture of the concrete footings being installed there on site. And if you forward to slide 29, you can see a picture of the final solar array. They utilized a fixed tilt mounting structure and a, I believe, crystalline panels, although I'm not, thin film panels, pardon me. Moving on to slide 30, we have Holmes Road Landfill. Now, as far as I know, this project is still under review and awaiting approval by the City of Houston. Now, this landfill has been closed since the 1970s, and a 10-megawatt array is planned for the southernmost 150 acres of the site. For more information, you can contact Rob Lawrence, EPA Region 6, or you can see the paper by SRA International that I've linked at the bottom of the page. Moving on to slide 31, we get into Nellis Air Force Base, which is a fairly well-publicized solar project, one of the largest photovoltaic projects in North America, I think. And the landfill at Nellis was closed in the late 1960s. 1996, the soil cover approved by the Nevada Department of Environmental Protection was placed over the landfill. And in total, the solar array covers 140 acres, 33 acres being placed on the landfill. On average, the solar array provides 25% of the base energy requirements. And for more information, you can contact Internal and Media Relations there at Nellis Air Force Base. And I've linked two case studies there at the bottom of the page, two fact sheets on a case study. Moving on to slide 32, you can see a good picture of the single-axis sun tracking mounting system there at Nellis, and they used, I think, polycrystalline panels. Okay, moving on to slide 33, we have Tessman Road Landfill. Mentioned this one several times before. They're out of San Antonio, Texas. And this was a simultaneous landfill closure and solar installation using the alternative cover design and the PV laminates. And coupled with the landfill gas system, the solar array produces 9 megawatts of electricity. For more information, you can contact Tony Walker, Public Services. And I've also linked a short video with respect to the project there at the bottom of the page. And again, here's a picture of the exposed geomembrane and the solar laminates. All right. Last but not least is Pensauken Landfill in Pensauken, New Jersey. Now, this landfill has three distinct sites with arrays placed on the top deck, side slope, or both. Electricity production from this project is about 2.1 megawatts. For more information, you can contact Mark Messix at PPL Renewables. And Mark also did a really great presentation back in June for the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection. And I linked provided a link to his presentation there at the bottom. Moving on to slide 36. These photos were provided courtesy of Mark Messix. The first one shows a picture of the top deck installation there at Pensauken. And the next one on page 37 shows a picture of the slide slope installation. And thanks again to Mark Messix for these pictures. All right, moving on to slide 38, concluding slide. So first off, the practice of placing solar energy systems on closed landfills. It's a relatively recent growing development. And closed landfills, by virtue of their large numbers, represent substantial potential to meet EPA's Repowering America's Lands initiative. Furthermore, there are a number of well-established benefits in environmental, economic, and socioeconomic contexts. However, recurring challenges that may not well be well understood are believed to be hindering current progress. The results from my paper suggest that numerous solar system technologies and engineering techniques are available to successfully navigate a solar project, but on the other hand, the permitting and regulatory processes are complicated by disparate state and local government requirements. Finally, while the scope of this work was rather narrow, I'm hoping that the material covered and the lessons learned will have benefits across a wider setting. And with that, I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in, and I'll welcome any questions or comments from the audience.
Thanks, Gabe. We're going to just take one question that we got here online to begin with, and then we'll start with questions on the phone. So, Gabe. In light of landfill caps, this comes from a gentleman in New Jersey. In light of landfill cap construction and operation and maintenance, what PV foundations are most commonly used? How does the designer or installer anticipate potential problems such as differential settlement, crack a slab, methane release from a concrete footing, or other potential issues? And finally, and I can reread this, what is the expected life of these structures?
This is sort of a tough question to tackle. I think a lot of these characteristics are going to be site-specific, so it's going to be tough for me to comment on them. But I think, as far as I know, the most commonly used foundation material would be the poured and prefabricated shallow concrete footings. As far as anticipating potential problems, I think doing your background research on the some of the characteristics of your landfill should give some good insight into that. You know, how old is it? What is the waste composition? And things like that. I think that should address it.
Okay. And if there are further follow-up on any of these questions that you'd like to have, you can contact Gabriel, and we'll get his contact information at the end. Maybe a couple more questions here. Another question that came in, it looks like from New Orleans. What is the typical size and acreage of these projects?
Again, that's going to have, context with the site-specific stuff. An important thing to consider there is, if you reach a certain size, you could become considered a regulated utility. So I think that's an important part of that question. As far as typical size, that's really going to depend on what you want to get out of the project there. Do you want to export electricity, or is it going to be used on site? What is the viable size of the landfill? Top deck. What's the size of the top deck? Is the side slope suitable for installing structures? I really can't give a typical size there.
Okay, and this question comes in from Fresno, California. How is the wash water for keeping the panels clean handled, I guess, typically? How is that best controlled on landfills, since the goal is to keep as much water off the landfill?
That's a really good question. I don't know an answer to that. I can... What happened to it? I could look into that and maybe get an answer back to you via email later this day, I guess would be my best answer.
Okay.
Please define raveling. Raveling is, I'll try to define raveling here. So raveling is pretty much the filling in of voids in the buried waste. So over time, you're going to, some of the smaller pieces of the waste are going to fill in voids of the voids left over from bulky materials.
Oh, yeah.
So that's pretty much what raveling is. Why it keeps our company's pleads.
I'll do the one from Ohio. This comes in from Cincinnati, Ohio. Do you have information on cost per megawatt installed for the various technologies?
Got an answer there. cost per megawatt.
Right there.
I'm not sure.
If there are questions that we can't answer right now, you can follow up again later with Gabe after the presentation.
Yeah, for that question is the cost. Go ahead and email me at the email address provided.
Just one question from Region 6, Ghulam Mustafa here. Is there any information on the performance of these existing systems which are already installed, or any problems have been noticed?
As far as I know, there haven't been. I think there are some predictable declines in output from year to year. I'm not sure what the what percent it is, but I think that's the only consequence that I've come across so far.
Okay, thank you.
Are there other questions on the phone?
Yeah, this is Tetra Tech in Santa Ana, California. We had a question on if Gabriel saw any information on how the electrical and control cabling was handled in light of the fact that that's typically anywhere, depending on the voltage, from 2 to 4 feet below grade, typically. and that really poses a challenge with the cover.
Right. Yeah, you're probably going to need, if you're planning on trenching your electrical cable and lines, you're probably going to need, a minimum of 2 feet of soil cap cover. I guess the only way around that, if you have a thin cover, is, importation of new fill or a redistribution of existing fill.
Can I just add something?
Go ahead.
I just one thing that I noticed on the technology for that incorporates the solar panels into the landfill cap, the Unisolar, I think, example, the cables were integrated into it. And I think if you read the report that Gabe put together for this presentation, you can see more of how they dealt with the electrical components in the Unisolar system, which did not involve trenching, I believe.
No, it didn't. It's concentrated solar.
Other questions on the phone?
There's a question here from ZZ in San Francisco I think I could take. The question is concentrated solar the best technology if wind, snow, and slope gradient aren't big problems? I think that's really going to depend, like I mentioned, on the linear concentrators. They're really optimized for large-scale operations, and if, the landfill is large enough to suit a big operation like that, and as long as the grade is flat enough to adequately support it, I wouldn't see any problems. Now, whether it would be preferred over a photovoltaic project, I can't comment on.
Okay. Other questions on the phone? We're kind of getting some questions coming in here online. So as those come in, do folks on the phone have questions? Please just chime in.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Ted Norwich for Public Services. The Tessman Road project, somebody asked a question about wiring and the depth of wiring from 2 to 4 feet. Kind of the short version is that the exposed geomembrane systems have a, an anchor trench requirement. So those membranes just aren't laying on top of the landfill. They're anchored at a set interval. And so those anchor trenches are fairly deep. They're lined, and a lot of the wiring is run in those anchor trenches. And so there's kind of this soil pack that's put around that, aligned and soil pack, and they're fairly deep, 2 to 4 feet deep. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thanks for commenting on that.
So we basically laid the arrays out in kind of coordinated anchor trenches along with the arrays.
But that doesn't require, does that require fill, the same amount of fill across the entire site?
Again, your anchor trenches are dug down, at that depth, they're dug into the waste, and there is waste removed, and then you have to backfill with a clean fill.
Got it.
And then you roll your membrane through that, and then you've got to place soil on top of that membrane. It's like a conventional anchor trench design, more or less, for a municipal solid waste landfill. And so you backfill with clean soil, you roll your liner through it, and then you still have a 2 to 4 foot trench that now is effectively lined, that you put a clean soil in, they kind of anchor that liner down to the slope. And so those anchor trenches kind of ran kind of laterally down the slope at a set interval. So hopefully I'm answering your question. To verbalize it a little bit, unless you're familiar with traditional anchor trench designs.
Okay. right. Thanks for that. I've got a question here from Jim Walsh from SES Engineers in Cincinnati. His question was, have there been any issues of damage from wildlife to the solar panels, deer running over the flat panels, for example? That's a good question. I think I addressed in my paper the need for fencing. I'm not sure how tall a fence needs to be to keep a deer out, probably pretty tall. But, yeah, that's a good point. You know, these sites should be fenced to keep out any deer or pesky hoodlums or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, when it comes to site maintenance, and you know, that site is fenced, and we haven't had a problem with wild animals, but all solar systems, any power system requires maintenance, and so you have to have a routine, SOP, you know, kind of that establishes how you inspect the system and maintain it. So nothing that would qualify as problematic or a reoccurring, you know, substantial issue, has been found on the kind of the thin-filmed exposed membrane application. It's gone pretty well, actually. So any system that you install, you just can't turn your back and walk away from it forever. I think everybody recognizes that there's cleaning and other things that are involved with management of those power systems.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that. We've got another question here from Scott Ekman from Vector Engineering in Grass Valley. Scott asks, are most systems readily... Sorry, I'll sit here. I've lost it. What happened? Well, I think he was asking, are most systems readily removable so that final cover maintenance involving the heavy equipment can be mobilized? I think the best way to answer that is it's really going to depend on what foundation materials you're using. Shallow concrete footings and ballast platforms, I think, shouldn't be too tough to remove. As far as the ease of removing them, I can't really comment, but I think that's something that I might address in the paper is the ultimate deconstruction aspect of the project. So I might have to get back to you on that one. Okay, got a several part question here from Gretchen Jansen from CDM there in Florida. Sorry, lost it again.
A little bit of system difficulties here. Bear with us.
Okay, have there been any problems placing the panels next to major roadways, i.e. glare disturbing drivers? Not that I'm aware of. But that is certainly something to take into consideration. Sure.
Something on the glare. This actually has come up at airports. So when they fight solar panels at airport facilities, that is a concern. The glare on the pilots when they're coming in for landings, and they do have low glare films that they can put over the panels to decrease the amount of glare. To the point that I understand that it's not an issue at airports, so for pilots coming in to make a safe landing.
Okay. And the second part of her question there was any comments or suggestions for extreme weather events, for example, from a hurricane. Is it possible? Sorry, folks. Is it possible to have adjustments to perhaps lower the panels to decrease the effect of wind loading if a hurricane warning is in effect? Also, how durable are the panels themselves? But I think the shims and adjusting adjustable racking support structures that I mentioned have you know, a limited amount of mobility as far as vertical. As far as vertical adjustments go, as far as, you know, doing a solar installation in Hurricane Alley, yeah, if you have sustained winds of you know, 100 miles an hour plus, I'm not sure if there's any mechanical load rating that's high enough to sustain that. If any have any...
Really flat.
Yeah. do you have any comment on the durability of the panels, expected life?
Typical 30 years life expectancy of a solar panel.
Another question coming in from Los Angeles from Gregory Walden. Is there a minimum size and installable land area on a cost-benefit basis for each of the technology types? You know, that's something I didn't address in the paper. There's the financing and economic aspects of these types of projects. It's something I'm really interested in, but I just didn't have time this summer. I think there are some resources that address this on the resources page there on the CLUIN website, so you might be able to find your answer there. But yeah, I didn't do any research explicitly addressing this summer, so sorry.
Are there other questions on the phone? Okay. Any other questions here you'd like to
over? There's no new ones.
No new ones. Okay. Well, if there are no further questions, we'd like to just wrap this up and thank you. Hello? Okay, and thank you all for joining us. I want to point you to the additional resources. If you go to the very last slide of the presentation, you'll see a link to additional resources. And there are all the resources that – it says links to additional resources. It's all the additional resources that went into Gabe's research. So please check those out, and it will also give you a draft of his paper that you can read in much more detail. And also you'll see the feedback form. If you could take some time to fill out that feedback form for us, we'd really appreciate it. And again, I'd like to thank you for your participation today in our CLUIN seminar, and we look forward to having future seminars on renewable energy. Thank you.